Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Easy to throw items in the trash and not think about it, but a recent New Hampshire legislative report wants us all to pay more attention, saying society generates a vast amount of refuse of mind-boggling variety, and virtually everyone is paying for it. And right now, the report says we're paying for most of our garbage to be put in landfills. That's despite environmental and health concerns about those facilities, and despite decades of messaging about reduce, reuse, recycle. Today in The Exchange, where our trash goes now and what the future might hold. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Mike Nork is here, environmental analyst at the Solid Waste Management Bureau at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Mike, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Mark Morgan, solid waste manager for the city of Lebanon. If you're curious, we have photos of his landfill on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Mark, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Nice to meet you as well.
Also with us, State Representative Karen Ebel, a Democrat from New London, the Deputy Speaker of the House. She chaired the legislature's committee to study recycling streams and solid waste management, which just released its report, as I mentioned. You can find that on the website as well. nhpr.org/exchange. And Representative Ebel, it's really nice to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So the study committee report says, quote, the issue of solid waste touches every aspect of society. And Representative Ebel, you first just connect the dots for us between solid waste, that sort of weekly routine, you know, going out to the curb to bring the trash or the recycling out, and as you put it, every aspect of society.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you again for featuring this really important subject that we don't all talk about that much, but it's such an integral part of all of our lives. We all buy many, many things, and many of the things that we buy generate waste, and there's just an awful lot of things going into our landfills. We all try to think about what we're doing with the things that we buy and where they go, but a lot of times we have no concept of what's happening with everything, and the more we listen to the radio, like your program and the news, we realize that we're having a great impact on our society, and we have to start thinking about it.
Give us a couple sort of pinpoints on that every aspect of society that is touched, you know, what we eat, what we wear, you know, the type of food we buy, you know, that sort
of
thing.
Well, when you go to the grocery store, you know, you're looking in the produce aisle, you're buying cereal, you're buying meats, and everything that you purchase pretty much, except for maybe a head of lettuce, is packaged in some kind of material. The meat is on styrofoam, the ice cream containers are made out of paper, you know, the milk cartons, everything has some sort of refuse associated with it, and maybe you're not thinking about that so much when you buy it, but when you unwrap, you know, that package of hamburger, the styrofoam goes into the trash can. And if you decide that you're going to buy a bottle of ginger ale, you know, a lot of times there's not a glass option. There's a plastic option. Sometimes you throw it away. Sometimes you don't. And other real convenience items that we buy, you know, like a small container of yogurt that you're just going to use once, throw that away, and that may not be recyclable.
What do you think, Mark, from your perspective, running the public landfill in Lebanon, this idea that solid waste touches every aspect of society?
Well, Karen is absolutely right that we need to rethink waste. As a culture, we seem to have redefined what waste is. At one point, waste or refuse or trash was something that had been repaired or reused and no longer had value. Now it's something I just don't want. So, you know, example is cell phones. You know, every 2 years we get a new contract and a new phone. There's nothing wrong with our phone, but we no longer want it, so it gets discarded. So She's absolutely right, and we just, it's a task that we do every day that is without a lot of thinking as far as what's at the other end of that bin.
What do you think, Mike?
So I think I agree with what's been said, and I know a lot of focus is put on residential activities, and that isn't the only trash or the only waste that's produced. I mean, there's construction activities, there's commercial waste, there's industrial waste. In New Hampshire, there's a large number of things that are regulated as solid waste that we don't always think of when we talk about waste or recycling. Things like contaminated soils that, you know, don't have hazardous components but are still contaminated with like oil or other petroleum products. There's things like electronic waste, which Mark definitely touched on, you know, items that are, you know, constantly being updated or, you know, coming, becoming obsolete. So there's all sorts of, like, waste, like Representative Ebel said, waste is something that is, it really encompasses all activities throughout society, not just residential activities, but also commercial and industrial and across the board, institutional.
Well, and the more you know, the more paralyzed you might feel, Mike. I mean, I prepared for the show, you know, last week, and over the weekend, I found myself, you know, I would have something and I'd think, okay, is this trash? Is this recycling? Which bin should I put it in? Can I compost it? So it can get overwhelming for folks.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially on the recycling front, it gets really confusing. And when we talk about plastics, I think that's the most confusing. There's so many different types of plastics. And even if it has a recycling symbol on it, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's definitely recyclable. That's just identifying what kind of resin the plastic is made from. So there's multiple layers of you know, it's hard for the regular consumer to really understand what they should be throwing in the recycling bin versus what needs to go in the trash. And it can vary town by town, region by region, state by state.
Well, we'll definitely get into the collapse of recycling markets in a few moments, for sure. But Representative Ebel, as part of pulling together this report, you and the committee visited a lot of landfills, and you write that, quote, the study committee members were at times overwhelmed when witnessing the sheer magnitude of trash. Describe what you saw. What was so overwhelming?
Well, we visited one landfill. We visited the Turnkey Landfill in Rochester. And then what we did was, and this I should explain, there's a couple of ways that municipalities can recycle. One is that the community members can come in and sort their recycling. So for a lot of small rural communities like where I come from, we sort our plastic and our glass and our paper. But the other aspect of it is what they call single stream recycling, which a lot of communities have decided to adopt, where you have one bin. I think you may do that in Concord.
Yes.
You have one bin and you throw everything that's recyclable into that bin. It's collected and then it's taken to a materials recovery facility, also called a MRF. And so what we did was we went to the Turnkey Landfill, which is owned by Waste Management, and then we went to the MRF, which is in Billerica. And the first place we went to was the MRF, and you just walk in there, and there are chutes going all over the place as all the different single stream recycling is dumped in, and it all has to be sorted. And so you have paper shooting off in one place. You have, you know, puffs of air sort of blowing different kinds of plastics in other bins. And then you literally have people standing in sorting areas pulling out plastic bags,
things that shouldn't be in that stream.
And so there's this category you call wish cycling, where people really do want to do the right thing, and they throw, you know, shovels and skateboards and all these things. But when you understand the technology for sorting out these recyclable goods, you understand that it's really important that you don't put things in that aren't recyclable by these facilities, because it just can really foul things up. So So when you walk into a facility like this very large MRF and you're just surrounded by what feels like the world's refuse, it just, I just kept looking at it and we were all looking at each other and we were like, this is what we're generating.
Yeah. And well, what about the landfill in Rochester?
Landfill.
That's a huge one, right?
It is huge. So you see, first you go from the situation where you feel the waste just swirling around you, and then ultimately they create these. I just want to fit. They create these huge bales that they ultimately will sell, and you feel like you're walking into the last, image of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, but then we went from there to the turnkey landfill, which is enormous, and you just see these. And you're at some remove when you're looking at it, so it doesn't look, the trucks don't look as huge as they actually are, but you have these enormous trucks dumping so many things into the landfill, and they have 100,000-pound machines that go back and forth crushing things so that they can maximize the amount of capacity in the landfill. And then when they're covered, they're just like mountains.
So shovels and skateboards. Mark, what other sort of odd items have you seen at your facility in Lebanon?
So like Mike was mentioning earlier about confusion and recycling, it's a big problem. We serve 23 communities at Lebanon, and there's a lot of confusion about what is or isn't recyclable.
Sure, I've been confused myself, and yeah. I probably do a lot of wish cycling, as Mike said.
So the sort has really not changed a whole lot in the last 10 or 15 years. The same things are recyclable at the curb. So items like plastic bags, typically those can get recycled at the local grocery stores, push them back. So it's not that they're not recyclable, they just shouldn't go in your bin. We see things like potato chip bags with aluminum cans simply because it's shiny. So there's confusion about what aluminum is and what it's not. These things that we hope to be recycled or recyclable ultimately end up in landfills at a huge expense. So when people wish that this item happens to be recyclable, they throw it in the bin and figure, well, somebody else smarter than me or who knows more about recycling will be able to determine this later. So this thought of when in doubt, throw it in the recycling bin is really damaging the recycling stream because it's contaminating good recycling efforts by others.
Have you ever pulled out a shovel or a skateboard or something else like that?
No, we find kiddie pools, snow fences in our plastic bales or in our plastic bins, just all sorts of just it's plastic, so it must be recyclable. And that, you know, as Mike mentioned, that's not the case.
Go ahead, Mike.
And just to add on that, I think another it's not just about miseducation or lack of education on the consumer's part. I think the other thing that's kind of working against folks right now is that packaging is evolving very fast. So there are new types of packaging coming out. Sometimes they're mixed materials. So you might see, like, I saw on the internet, I saw somebody advertising a plastic steel can, like not a steel can, a plastic see-through steel can with a steel top. So it's a mixed material thing.
So what do you do with that?
Right. So there's a lot of new things coming out and new flexible film packaging like pouches, like the old Capri Suns. Now that kind of packaging is being used for things like detergent or other consumer items. So there's just a lot more stuff out there now, and it's really confusing as to what can go in the recycling because people just don't know because it's just coming up so fast. And the recycling industry, these MRFs, haven't changed their technology significantly since, you know, the early 2000s. So that sort that Mark was talking about hasn't changed. You know, the looking for paper, cardboard, plastic bottles and cans, or rather steel cans and aluminum cans, you know, that kind of stuff.
It's not as simple as it used to be. And relating to what you're saying about the packaging, here's an email that we got from Kevin in Manchester who says, where do you see EPR, extended producer responsibility, fitting into the solution of garbage? Kevin says, manufacturers are allowed to produce as much waste as the market demands, and the townships and taxpayers are left with appropriately discarding this waste. Do you think, Kevin asks, that producers should be required to use more sustainable packaging or pay taxes on single-use waste? Kevin, thank you very much. And Representative Ebel, what do you think?
Well, I have to say this was an area that was fascinating, that when we were having the hearings, it's also a fairly complex area. So given the amount of time, we weren't able to get so closely acquainted with it as we would like. One of the most interesting discussions we had was this sort of intersection between the corporations that are manufacturing goods, that they need to market them in attractive ways, but also functional ways. Also, the people who are making the packaging that the producers want, and they have conversations. And we had somebody from Stonyfield there, then we had a plastics manufacturer there, and then the issue of the folks who are being asked to sort all these things. And backing into it, when we were at the MRF,
just remind us what the MRF is, just in case somebody just tuned in.
Yes, this is the Materials Recovery Facility, that they sort the single stream recycling. One of the most interesting discussions we had was, I said, because you're being required to sort these things, would it be beneficial from a sales standpoint if the types of packaging that you were getting were more refined? And he said, absolutely.
What does that mean, refined?
Less complicated.
Sure.
More easily
simpler.
You know, there are things like the plastics and water bottles are much easier to recycle than a chip bag. And I asked him, is there a lot of discussion about packaging? And he said that there was. I think that manufacturers and the people who are deciding what to put their products in definitely should take more responsibility for what's going on.
Kevin, thank you very much for the email. And Mark, I can see you want to jump in.
Sure. And the email itself, you know, uses the phrase sustainable packaging. And I think that can be a very loaded term, because what is sustainable? Mike mentioned earlier the use of film plastic pouches, and there are some who would say that is sustainable packaging, even if it's not recyclable because it's consuming less resources for that package. Stonyfield Yogurt years ago moved from a number 2 plastic to a number 5. Even though at the time the number 5 plastic was not recyclable, number 5 plastic allows the manufacturer to make it thinner. So they were consuming less resources.
Oh, so there's choices here.
Right.
Trade-offs.
So, and the smaller packaging consumes less fuel to move to market. So, you know, how are we defining sustainability in that regard?
So reduce, reuse, recycle. Recycle is the last part of that phrase. And yet we do tend to, in these conversations, focus so much on recycling, maybe because it makes us feel good that, you know, here's this plastic bottle, but at least I can throw it away. So coming up after a short break, I want to ask all of you about the other two pieces of that equation, the reduce and the reuse. Also, I'm going to ask you why New Hampshire's landfills are getting pretty full and what we're going to do about that when it happens. I've got another email from someone who's pretty upset that half of our landfill inputs, if I can put it that way, come from other states. Mike, I know you get this all the time. Why are we, if our landfills are getting full, why are we taking in stuff from elsewhere? Shouldn't we make them deal with our own trash? That's the tenor of the email that I've got. Love to take some more of your emails. You can send them in at exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can comment on Facebook, you can tweet us, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, despite decades of messages about reduce, reuse, recycle, Most of our trash still goes to a landfill, but those facilities themselves are now filling up. A new report outlines the problem and possible solutions. We're hearing about that, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are State Representative Karen Ebel. She's Deputy Speaker of the House. She's a Democrat from New London. And she's chair of the committee that put together this report that we're talking about, the Committee to Study Recycling Streams and Solid Waste Management. Mark Morgan is also here, Solid Waste Manager for the City of Lebanon, and Mike Nork, Environmental Analyst at the Solid Waste Management Bureau at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Representative Ebel, to you very quickly. So study committees are not unusual in New Hampshire. When there's a big problem, often there's a study committee appointed. But yours really came out of local frustration with this issue. So just tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, sure. Well, I have to say I spent many hours driving up Route 89 listening to NHPR with stories about how municipalities were really struggling. Their tipping fees, which is the per ton price that you pay when you bring something to a landfill, were increasing. They were getting less and less money for their recycled goods, and a lot of towns had stopped recycling, and I just became increasingly concerned that things were really going awry. And so that's why I introduced the original bill, and it was originally focused on recycling, but through the hearing process, I came to understand that it was a much broader topic and that we needed to talk about solid waste management as a whole. And that sort of led us down a very long path that focused a lot on landfills, but on a lot of other information.
Mike, how many landfills do we have in New Hampshire and how filled up are they?
So we have 6 operating lined landfills in the state. Mark is an operator of one of them in Lebanon. There's Conway, Nashua. Those three, Lebanon, Conway, Nashua, are the publicly owned facilities. And then there are 3 large commercial facilities. There's Mount Carberry, which is in Success. And Bethlehem is the NCES, or North Country Environmental Services, landfill. And then there's the turnkey landfill over in Rochester, which was mentioned earlier.
And what's the difference between a public and a private landfill? Obviously, there's the for-profit, not-for-profit financial structure, but how does that make
these different? It's a function
of who
owns the landfill. So in the case of Lebanon, it's owned by the city, or Nashua owns their landfill. And these other facilities that are commercial, they are owned by private entities or entities that don't function, they're not public entities. And they also, generally speaking, will have an unlimited service area. So they're able to receive waste from just about anywhere within the state or out of state.
So what are some of the environmental concerns about landfills? Because, on one hand, there's just this issue of we have all this stuff, we're taking up space. But what are the environmental concerns, Mike? I mean, besides taking up valuable land and not being so pretty to look at, what's the problem with a landfill?
Well, I mean, the foundational problem with landfills and the reason why it's lowest on the state's waste management hierarchy as a preferred management method for waste is because you're not recovering resources. You're putting stuff into the ground in perpetuity. You're not able to realize the full potential of those materials that could be reused. The other problem is that there may be potential for leachate generation, right? A lot of these landfills that are operating generate a pretty significant amount of leachate on a daily basis.
What is leachate?
So it's basically the moisture component in a landfill. It's either generated from the decomposition of the waste or it's from precipitation at an operating landfill that kind of infiltrates as waste is added to the landfill, and it percolates through and it collects different constituents from within that waste mass. And operating landfills have a liner system so that they
so the soil collect is that, somewhat protected?
They collect that leachate and funnel it where it can be processed.
Aren't most landfills lined? I mean, if there's concern about groundwater and everybody's worried about PFAS these days.
The reason I said operating landfills is because the state also has about 300 closed landfills. These are the old municipal landfills.
See.
that, you know, it used to be the town dump, right?
And those are not lined.
And a lot of those were unlined. And so they've been since closed and capped, which helps to limit the amount of precipitation that gets into the landfill. But they still have to be monitored and maintained to make sure that that waste mass doesn't get compromised.
I see.
And then, you know, the longstanding kind of concern with that is that you have potential for groundwater contamination.
Right. And everyone is very concerned about some of the items leaching out of those items that are underneath the landfill.
Absolutely. So for multiple reasons, landfills are not a very sustainable long-term, you know, waste management method.
Well, speaking of what happens to the stuff that is in a landfill, the fifth graders at Fuller School in Keene sent us a couple emails, and that's great. I love that they're listening and that they're asking questions. Seth asks, what happens after trash decomposes? And Mark, can you answer that?
Trash does not decompose. That is a myth. We've done construction projects, and a lot of landfill operators do construction projects. And we've dug into sections of the landfill in Lebanon that was 30 years old and pulled a book out or a newspaper, and it's still legible.
Not even a newspaper?
No. Landfills are, for decomposition, you need oxygen, moisture, and some bacterial growth.
Like a composter.
Right. So landfills are really designed a lot like Egyptian tombs. It's a dry tomb method. You try to remove oxygen and you try to remove moisture. As Mike was talking about with leachate, part of what we do is to minimize leachate production. So it actually does not decompose. There's some settlement, but decomposition is very minimal.
So when we think of decomposition, we think of our composter. We think of a banana peel or an apple core, which a year or two later turns into this beautiful soil, which helps me grow beautiful flowers, by the way. I'm a big fan of my composter. So Vinny, also from the Fuller School, asks, can we use trash as fuel? And this is a great question, Vinny, and one that I want to ask you guys anyway. So who wants to take that first? Mike?
Yeah, that's definitely, that is actually one of the methods that's used in New Hampshire. There's a facility here in Concord or in Penacook that is called a waste-to-energy facility, and it's basically a giant incinerator that takes the trash, burns it at thousands of degrees, and generates electricity.
So is that a good thing? Is that clean? Burning trash sounds kind of dirty.
It does sound dirty. I'm sure it used to be dirtier than it is now. There are very strict pollution controls. It's something that's become more common in New England because we have less space. We're more populated, so we don't have a lot of space to put trash, and it's very expensive to ship it long distances. And it's also very popular in Europe. A lot of countries in Europe utilize waste to energy as their primary waste management method. Huh. And it's preferable because you do reduce the volume of waste that ultimately needs to be disposed. You just have to dispose of the ash at the end of the day. And you are able to recover some energy. So it's a little bit more preferable than just a straight, you know, landfill.
Representative Ebel, having done all this work, how do you feel about waste to energy? Someone listening might think, that sounds perfect. We'll just burn it and create energy. It's win-win-win.
Well, I agree with Mike that although a lot of folks haven't been that enthusiastic about waste-to-energy incinerators, they actually are better because they greatly reduce the amount that goes into the landfill. It ultimately is ash. And you also get energy out of it. And, you know, on the topic of how all things are interrelated, because of the costs of natural gas decreasing, the electricity that's being produced as a result of the waste to energy burning, they're having trouble to compete to sell their energy. And I just like to get back a little bit to the landfills and to Seth's question. The thing is that in order to make the landfills safe, because they have to last into perpetuity, you really do have to set up a tomb-like structure. And Mark's term was absolutely right. What you're doing is you're really securing things. But in doing that, you're pretty much ensuring that there's not going to be much deterioration in the landfill itself. So when we visited Turnkey, that actually was my impression. I just looked like this was a mass entombment of society's refuse. And it just it kind of shook all of us.
It's sobering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's take a call, and this is Michael calling in from Bedford. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. Ever since China banned our recyclables, it costs as much to recycle waste in this country as dispose of it, which never was the case. And the reason is our industries don't use it as a raw material like China's did. And as far as I know, there's no comprehensive effort to look at all of our industrial manufacturing processes and see where recyclables can be the raw material. We have little welcome mats and knickknacks, things like that, but not on the scale China was using it.
You know, Michael, this is a great point. And Mark, I'd love your thoughts first, but anybody jump in. You know, China, he's right, was using our sort of leftovers to make stuff. And I think he's right that there isn't really a major market for reusing this stuff, recycling it in a meaningful way. You might like buy a jacket or a keychain, but go ahead. I'd love your thoughts.
It's again, I think that's another one of the myths is that there are no domestic markets. Our facility in Lebanon markets all of our recyclables domestically. We don't ship anything overseas. And they're producing goods here in the United States using recyclable materials.
So who's buying it from you?
A variety of places. We have a manufacturer that purchases our plastic to make outdoor furniture.
Okay.
And it's not always, you know, you could be fooled. Anything steel contains recycled content steel, but it doesn't say this contains recycled content. A lot of paper products do. In New Hampshire, there's a requirement for all newspapers to have a percentage of post-consumer recycled content. So it's out there more than we realize. And unfortunately, all the press has been on China and not on domestic capacity building. And there's a lot of domestic capacity building in the United States. There's a new plastics recycling facility being built in New Jersey. There's just a lot more than people realize is going on.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so that's could be considered good news, Mark, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, just to add on what Mark was saying, I think part of the narrative in the news media has been that China took the majority of our recyclables, and they only took about, on average, probably about 30% of the recyclables that we generated here in the United States. So the rest of the vast majority of the recycling that happened in the United States was actually supported by North American markets, whether in Canada or in the United States. And, you know, there, like Mark said, there's a lot of investment now that China has really shut off its doors to our, you know, that 30% of the recycling stuff that we generated. There is actually investment in paper mills. For example, in Rumford, Maine, there was a company called Nine Dragons, which is actually a Chinese company, bought a mill, and they're going to use it to make pulp and then ship that pulp back over to China to continue supporting the manufacturing sector in China for product packaging and for paper making and things like that. So.
Well, Michael, I'm glad you called because this generated an answer that, you know, I didn't realize that there was so much domestic recycling going on and in useful ways, as you say, Mark. Here's an email that came in earlier from John, who says he's the founder of Save Forest Lake. He says, our fight in Dalton, New Hampshire this year, relative to Casella's planned 180-acre landfill right next to our beloved lake, is so connected to all of this. Preserving the pristine environment we all enjoy here in the North Country, tourism, the dollars it brings, along with their single-use trash, our fight for clean air and water, prevention of leachate contamination here and elsewhere, and the fact that New Hampshire is importing so much trash and our elected officials turn a seemingly blind eye to the matter, John says, have led to some serious networking with other groups throughout the state and beyond. John goes on to say, New Hampshire does not have a landfill capacity shortage. Casella does, as they need a new home to continue to bring in out-of-state trash. Landfill figures from the legislative committee confirm that there is plenty of room for New Hampshire trash, but they continue to be filled at a much faster rate due to Casella and Waste Management importing trash. This is an issue that bothers a lot of people. And I'm going to turn to you, Representative Ebel. If our landfills are getting pretty full, as your report says, why are we taking stuff from elsewhere? Why don't we just deal with our own trash, not other people's?
Well, I have to start this out by saying I'm a New Hampshire native, and it doesn't exactly rub me the right way either. But I think it's important that folks understand that under federal law and the Interstate Commerce Clause, there have been several lawsuits at very high levels that have determined that you can't ban out-of-state trash from coming in. So that's an initial point that I certainly didn't understand until we got farther into the topic. I would defer to Mike to talk a little bit more deeply about how DES does the analysis on in-state versus out-of-state trash in the permitting. But
I also read, Representative Ebel, that New Hampshire doesn't charge. Has it, a lot of other states have a specific charge that New Hampshire doesn't impose. And so, you know, trash companies from Connecticut and Rhode Island say, great, let's go to New Hampshire. It's
well,
cheap there.
It is. So that's a whole other subject. It is true that an awful lot of states have a surcharge that they put on to trash that whenever it goes to the landfill, and we do not. However, based on this 2013 survey that Mike provided to us during the hearing process, those fees aren't astronomical. And I would, I mean, there may be $1 to $5 per ton. I don't think that's the driver at all for why some states are bringing their trash here. The driver is that it's just flat out less expensive here to put their stuff because we have more capacity than they do in their own states. And if you take a state like Massachusetts, they're starting to shut down their landfills. And that means that there's less capacity, so they're looking around this, the especially from around Boston or whatever, they're looking for a place to bring their refuse. The other thing that really struck me is that there are in the region, states are starting to have disposal bans where, like, we don't allow leaf and yard waste to go into landfills. Vermont, for instance, is really decreasing the amount of food waste that can go into its landfills. Massachusetts, for example, no longer lets construction and demolition debris go into their landfills. So when we were all sitting in the van looking at what was being dumped into the turnkey landfill, there was a whole load of construction debris from Massachusetts.
They've got to put it somewhere, and New Hampshire allows it.
Yeah, so if you're a state that is banning X, you look around for where it can be dumped. And this gets back to your original question, was how it affects all aspects of, so it's all so interrelated, and much of it is driven by economics, honestly.
I have a couple emails that I want to share with you and then get your reaction after a break. Suzanne from Hebron says, can you address what is possible for reducing food waste in landfills? What are other states doing? Also, Barb in Goffstown says, what can be done to support and encourage our local transfer stations to set up community composting? It would be great if they were a drop-off for people who can't or don't backyard compost. Barb says, by the way, food in our waste stream is a large percentage and contributes to methane gas being released. Composting would reduce our waste stream and have a lot of additional benefits, sharing hummus for gardening. Barb and Suzanne, we will definitely address the food waste issue after a short break because you're right, it's huge. And we'll keep taking more of your emails at exchange@nhpr.org or your phone calls, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, The Fundamentals of Impeachment. That's tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, why so much of our trash still goes to landfills despite decades of messages about reduce, reuse, recycle. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. And Mark, just before the break, we got a couple emails from listeners who wanted to know why the state or various communities don't encourage more food composting, recycling, if you want to call it that. What percentage of food waste is part of that overall waste stream that you're dealing with in Lebanon?
So it really ranges depending on where you're located, but it can be between 15 and 20% of the overall waste stream is compostables or food waste. The The barriers right now, sorry, Mike, are permitting. And I know the state is working on how to accommodate some possible growth in this industry. There's a lot of interest in New Hampshire and in the region from, you know, not only the listeners, but commercial entities who would like to start compost facilities. So, and it does produce a good product. And as Mike mentioned earlier in the hour, it's not just homeowners, it's restaurants, it's institutions, it's the commercial food waste and compostable waste stream is much larger than what we see in our own home.
So what's the permitting problem?
It's just understanding the process that the permitting process is old and needs to be updated. And I'm sure Mike can address that a bit more, but it's just, and frankly, some of it is perception that some folks just feel that, you know, just filling out a form is difficult. The state has something called a permit by notification, which is pretty flexible. But there are some issues, and you got to do it right in order for it to work.
So, and Michael, I'll let you jump in for sure, but just a couple fundamentals for people who may not be familiar with this. So I've got my backyard composter. I think the city gave it out for free. So we've had it for a number of years. We put all our banana peels and coffee grounds and leaves and stuff in there. But if you live in an apartment or you don't have the ability to compost, what do you do? What are your options? Because that was one of the questions from our emailers.
Well, right now there are very few options. Up in Lebanon, we work with a small local hauler that actually does pick up food waste at the curb, and we compost it at our facility.
You do? Okay.
To manufacture a soil that we're required to put on the landfill. We're required to put 12 inches of soil on the landfill, so we manufacture our own topsoil on site using waste.
Well, okay, and there's nothing better for growing flowers and vegetables than compost. So go ahead, Mike.
So I agree with Mark. I think the state could do more to encourage composting. We'd obviously love to see more composting infrastructure, like Mark was alluding to, rather than seeing more landfills or other things that aren't necessarily promoting higher and better use of resources. And I think DES is fully cognizant of the fact that our rules for composting are out of date. They could benefit from updating. The last time I was on the show talking about composting, we had a stakeholder work group that was helping DES to Mark was actually on that stakeholder work group to help DES figure out what avenues we might pursue for revising those rules.
So like a group of outside experts and people in the field who can help you look at revising.
And we got a lot of great feedback from stakeholders. And there are a lot of opportunities to update the rules. The problem is that DES right now doesn't have the resources to be able to really devote time and energy to that project, among the other things that we're trying to also work on, including permitting. So it's really a juggling act, and that's part of the problem is just not having the staff and the resources to really be able to make progress on that, which is frustrating for us as it is for the general public.
So you agree with the criticism, but you just don't have the people power to do it.
Right. When we're given the choice between doing that or updating the state solid waste management plan or tracking legislation at the state house or working on a permit application. Part of what's changed for us in the past year is that permit applications now auto-approve because of a change in state law. So if they are not acted on and we don't issue a decision within a certain time frame, those permits automatically approve, which could be problematic for a solid waste facility
or
a recycling facility.
Make sure it's safe.
Right. You want to make sure that these facilities are going to be operated and in compliance with the rules.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. And Reeve is calling in from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey. I love the conversation. I live in Wolfboro, and I have two things I wanted to say. One is a systemic thing, and one is a specific. And I solve my problem because I buy almost nothing with a label. We have a health food store here, and so I can go in and I take jars. They have a wall of bulk, so I can buy all the nuts and grains and seeds and anything I want that way, dried fruits. And I take my own jars now. This is the year that I decided I have to get better at this. So In fact, recently when I went in, I realized I didn't have my jars. I'm like, okay, you don't get nuts till tomorrow then. So,
but Reeve, you know, good for you, but I have to say most people don't have the patience to do that.
You know, we have, you know, that takes me to my second point. We have systemic issues with how we think about the world. It is an embarrassment that our trash is being shoved off onto Bethlehem or anywhere else. We say we don't have the patience, but do we have the patience for the trash we're making? So the systemic question that I wanted to point out is, at the same time that we are endeavoring to stop using single-use plastics, there's a type of plastic plant called, a plastic manufacturing plant called ethane crackers that are being put into the same Appalachian communities which we trash with coal. Now they're trying to put more and more ethane cracker plants there, going systemically against what we're trying to do.
Well, Reeve, thank you for calling. And Mark, you know, she's trying to live her values. Yes, it's a little bit more of a pain to, you know, go in and measure the nuts and measure the honey and measure the peanut butter and so forth. I haven't yet to see bulk pasta sauce, so I'm waiting for that. But what about you? And you've got, by the way, you've got a reusable coffee mug here with a sticker on it that says reuse. What does it say?
Refill, not landfill.
Refill, not landfill. Okay.
Yeah. So in Lebanon, 2 years ago, we started a campaign with the very basic understanding that the landfills last longer if you don't put stuff in them. So the concept is exactly that, to encourage our customers and citizens throughout the Upper Valley to reduce the amount of waste that they're putting in the landfill. So for the month of April, it's designated as Refill Not Landfill Month. And we've been working with local merchants. You know, we're working with coffee shops in the Upper Valley to develop a reusable coffee cup program that's shared cooperatively throughout the Upper Valley, as well as working with the local food co-op to develop quick, convenient reuse opportunities so you can grab your nuts and head back out, but it's a reusable container.
Go ahead, real quick, Representative Ebel.
Well, I just appreciate Reeve's comments. It just shows you again how interrelated everything is. And it is true that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to go to bulk food stores and get so many things that are in bulk or in glass, although they should. I think
that's true, too. A lot of people don't, even if they wanted to do what Reeve does,
they don't
live close to one
but
of these stores.
But I think the point that I wanted to make was a lot of it is just habit when you go to the grocery store. If you have to, if you're buying bananas, you don't have to put the bananas in a plastic bag. If you're buying one green pepper, you don't have to put, you know, so you can try to be more thoughtful about what you're doing to reduce your waste.
Mike, real quick.
So I think what Mark was talking about with his campaign in Lebanon and what Reeve was getting at with her comments really touches on a fundamental problem with society and our consumerism, right? And that's really, ultimately, the amount of waste that we generate is a result of our consumer practices. And what I alluded to earlier was the waste management hierarchy in the state. This was established back in the early 90s, and it put landfilling at the bottom, least preferred, and at the very top is source reduction. And the whole idea of source reduction is reducing the amount of waste at the source or not generating waste in the first place. And so that's where the biggest opportunity is for us to really reduce how much we're putting in a landfill or how much we're disposing of at the end of the day.
Yeah, and there's a lot you can do, but at some level you're also sort of, the manufacturers have something to do with this. As we talked about earlier, if you absolutely need X and it only comes in a thick plastic jug, then.
And in some ways the manufacturing sector is responding to that demand. You're seeing plastic bottles that are produced with much thinner plastic than they used to be. So that's a type of source reduction in itself is using thinner, lighter materials. And it goes back to what Mark was talking about, too, where, you know, what is sustainable? Do we want to have materials that can be recycled, or do we want to have materials that have a lower carbon footprint? Do we want to try to do both?
Yeah, that's a tricky balance. Okay, back to our listeners. And Kevin is calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you. thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question slash comment is that I'm aware that virgin plastic is cheaper to produce than recycled plastic from manufacturers because of the heavily subsidized fossil fuels. And my question is there any effort in place to maybe make a policy that would incentivize manufacturers to be using recycled products instead of the virgin materials?
That is a really interesting question. Who wants to jump in on that one? Yeah?
Sure, I'll jump in. I think a lot of it comes down to us. I think many times we're very quick to point to manufacturers as not making good decisions. But as consumers, as Mike pointed out, we have power in our wallet. And if it's something that we feel passionate about, we need to take the time, do some research and find out who's using recycled content products and support those companies and businesses.
All right, let's take another one. This is Matthew in Nashua. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about the Nashua landfill back in, I believe it was the late 90s, had a program where they pumped air out of the pile in Nashua, ran it through a generator that ran off of the methane. At the time, the technician there had said that they would have been able to reduce the pile in 15 years down to nothing, scraped out the toxics, and you would have been back down to a usable landfill. I'm curious whether what happened to that program, and if that's something that, even though it would cost more to run, if it wouldn't be, in the end, economically feasible.
Thank you very much for the question. We did talk a little bit earlier about waste to energy based on those questions from the fifth graders in Keene. But Mark, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. There's a lot of, it's referred to as waste conversion technology, where we're converting waste into energy products. What he's referring to in Nashua, I can't speak exactly to that point, but a lot of these technologies are emerging. There's a facility in Maine that's currently coming online where they're doing waste conversion technology. So it is an emerging sector of this industry, but it does not answer the issue of we're generating too much waste.
Go ahead, Representative Ebel, please.
Thank you. This doesn't respond directly to the issue about Nashua, but what we observed, for instance, at Turnkey, and it's possible Casella is doing this also.
Turnkey, again, is the big
landfill. So landfills emit an awful lot of what they call landfill gas. And the landfill gas, if you harness it appropriately, can be used to make energy to sell electricity, and that's what they were doing at the Turnkey facility. Again, you know, you're buffeted by the economics, so they still have to sell the electricity that they're making. But when you consider how much of the landfill gas is being emitted and that about 50% of it is methane and a greenhouse gas, it really is something that we need to do a better job with.
Mark?
So from the Rochester landfill, they do actually pipe the gas to Durham, to UNH, where they heat a portion of the campus using landfill gas. In Lebanon, we're going to be installing an engine to produce electricity there as well. And it is fairly common. Nashua also has a gas-to-energy program.
Did you want to jump in, Mike, too, on that?
And just to add, I think Casella up in Bethlehem, I believe, is working on a project with Liberty Utilities to basically convert their landfill gas into natural gas that can be used by Liberty Utilities in their lines.
Okay, and here's an email that came in from Julie. Please address the out-of-state waste question further, which we did talk about that a moment ago. Julie says, as we said, due to Interstate Commerce Clause, New Hampshire DES is unable to require private landfill owners to take in-state waste only. Publicly held landfills such as Lebanon and Mount Carberry can make their own choices, including not accepting out-of-state waste. For this reason alone, New Hampshire should be moving toward publicly owned facilities, which is the direction that Maine has gone. Representative Ebel, I'm going to turn to you. Is this something that you're looking at now that you've done this report? I know that you're working on all sorts of legislation for when the new session begins in January.
It's a really important question. I would say, again, given the unbelievable time constraints and the broadness of the topic, we didn't go too deeply into it. But New Hampshire does have statutorily a framework where municipalities can come together and form solid waste districts. And if they did that, they could have publicly owned landfills. Of course, you do still have to get into the siting issue, and not a lot of people are enthusiastic about having a landfill in their town. But it certainly would give the municipalities the ability to restrict what they take in to in-state.
And based on this report and all the research that you and the committee did, what types of areas, what types of legislation do you expect to be introducing in the new session, focusing on what areas of this problem?
Well, there's a variety. I would say the first one that we're going to do is to restructure the statutes to enable DES to better track what's coming into the state and what's being disposed of. And that was at the suggestion of the department, because because we also want to introduce legislation that requires us to reduce what we're landfilling by about 25% by 2030 and 45% at a minimum by 2050. We'll see how that part of it goes. So that's one thing that we're working on. We also want to institute a disposal surcharge of maybe $1 or $1.50 on per ton rates, in part to help fund proper staffing at DES and also to push money back down to the municipalities.
All right. A lot more we could have talked about. We could have just done a show on composting, just done a show on recycling, just done a show on reducing that waste stream. But we covered it all, and I'm sure we'll be talking again. Thank you all very much for being here. And thank you for coming down from Lebanon, Mark. Appreciate it. That's Mark Morgan, Solid Waste Manager for the City of Lebanon. And Mike Nork, thank you for coming in as well. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Mike Nork, Environmental Analyst at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And State Representative Ebel, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
You can read State Representative Ebel's report from her committee to study recycling streams and solid waste management on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.